break up.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Imam believed that the authority of Islam and of the people would eliminate the problems of the country. Imam used to think that the two words, Republic and Islamic, would untie the knots in the problems of the country. He believed that the key to all the problems of the country lay in the implementation of Islam and the presence of the people at the scene. This was Imam's opinion. When he said the Islamic Republic, not a word less and not a word more. Any word less means a republic without Islam or an Islam without a republic. That does not make sense. Imam said that there should be an Islamic Republic. This means the authority of Islam and the authority of people, which are interconnected and which are not contradictory in any way. The governance of Islam means that values and orientations are determined by Islam. The authority of the people means that the way the government is managed is decided by the people. This is what the authority of Islam and of the people mean. The people's willpower is influential, so are Islamic rules. Imam considered this a problem-solving phenomenon. And the truth of the matter is that it can solve all the problems of the country. Whenever we enlisted the help of the people, and whenever we acted according to Islam, we made a step forward. That was the case during the time of Imam, and it has also been the case since his demise until today. I can say this confidently, and this can be supported by numerous pieces of evidence in front of everyone's eyes. Whenever we involved the people, and whenever we made Islam the standard and the main criterion, we moved forward. However, whenever one of these two pillars became shaky, we screeched to a halt.
Since the onset of the bloody war on Yemen, the United Kingdom has always insisted that it's not a party to the Saudi-led campaign. Despite all the denials, the British military has always been playing a key role in maintaining the Saudi war machine, especially in training, advising, and supplying the Saudi Air Force bombing the country. New documents have shed further light on the corners of this sinister cooperation.
الحادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Declassified UK has now discovered that Britain has a secret detachment of up to 30 troops in Yemen, where they are training Saudi forces in the middle of the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe.
Well, it should be hugely significant given what it uncovers, British complicity in torture, which goes back many years. Britain was a key player in the Bush presidential administration's war on terror, helping with rendition and torture. We know this. The cases were brought to court in this regard. But sadly, we have a crisis of our news media in the UK. This story has not been picked up by any of the mainstream media organisations, the BBC, ITV, Sky News, etc. And so the public is not being made aware of these revelations. Declassified UK has done a great job since it was established in investigating the dark and murky corners of British foreign policy. But it's not receiving its due coverage in the mainstream media, because we don't have a media which in a normal democracy has a mission of holding the powerful to account on behalf of the people. We today in Brexit Britain have a media that sees its role, a mainstream media that sees its role as holding the people to account on behalf of the powerful.
The British personnel are reportedly based at Al Rayda Airport in Mahra province of eastern Yemen. The troops are believed to have been there for several months. In the words of Hamid Zabnout, a tribal sheikh in Mahra, the tasks assigned to them so far are military training and logistical support, either for Saudi forces or Saudi-backed militia that are elements from the Southern Transitional Council, a Yemeni separatist group. Local sources say the British troops are flown into the airport by Saudi military aircraft and bypassed normal visa checks. Since the Saudis have banned mobile phones inside the airport, it is almost impossible to film or photograph the British troops. In an interview with Britain's ambassador Michael Aaron in late June, Yemen's Al Mahriya TV channel repeatedly questioned him over allegations of UK forces having been seen in the east of the country. This is how the British ambassador replied.
نحن نساعد جهود مكافحة الإرهاب وجهود مكافحة التحريض وهذا كان موقفنا من زمان. عندنا علاقات جيدة ووثيقة مع الحكومة الشرعية.
Fighting terrorism with up to 30 forces in a country existentially threatened by the Saudi-led war is a claim dismissed by many as untenable.
Well, they are there to aid the state terrorism that's been unleashed by the Saudis on the people of Yemen. That's very clear. This is doublethink on the part of the British ambassador, Mr. Eaton. This is them trying to justify something that cannot be justified by saying that they're fighting terrorism. When you're on the side of the Saudis fighting terrorism, then you have to take a sharp look at yourself in the mirror. The Saudis practice terrorism. This is less a country and more a family business whose primary business is murder. Just ask the widow of Jamal Khashoggi or his bereaved fiancée, rather, if you want that confirmed. Never mind the thousands of people who were routinely executed in that kingdom of blood. So Mr. Eaton is, again, showing his true colours, not as an ambassador of British democracy, but as an ambassador of British state crimes abroad, that The Saudis have unleashed hell on Yemen since 2015. It's a disaster for the people of Yemen. Thousands and thousands have died. People have suffered famine, disease. Thousands of children have died every single day. And the British are up to their neck in blood, in Yemeni blood. That's the reality.
Matt Khalashat, a provincial deputy for youth affairs, estimates that Saudi and Western forces have built more than 100 underground cells inside the airport. Rights organizations say Saudi forces run a prison camp inside the airport in which detainees are subject to cruel torture or degrading treatment. According to Geneva-based advocacy group SAM for Rights and Liberties, Yemenis are being tortured by the British-backed Saudi forces at the airport.
Bertolt Brecht, the great German playwright in the 1930s and 40s, said it best. The crimes pile up so high they become invisible. And the crimes of the British state have become so, so invisible because there are so many of them, and that people are distracted by tittle-tattle, by the identity politics, by celebrity, by sport, etc. But this is a sordid turn of events when you have British military personnel, a country that likes to consider itself a pillar of human rights and stability and standing for everything good in the world, has its own military personnel complicit in the torture of Yemeni nationals. It's a disgrace.
Whereas the Saudi-imposed blockade has left millions of Yemeni civilians on the brink of famine, turning the airport into a prison where arbitrary detention and torture are practiced, all with the help of the British, indicates how far London is willing to go in support of authoritarian regimes such as Riyadh. According to SAM's president, Tawfiq Al-Hamidi, Saudi forces operate the airport's prison where they receive logistical support and military training by British troops stationed at the airport since the beginning of this year.
Britain is playing a material role in the war in Yemen. British soldiers have been training Saudi troops who are destined to go to Yemen to fight. British RAF personnel have been helping Saudi's air war against Yemen. They've been helping with targeting. They've been helping with equipment. They've been helping to maintain equipment. They are deeply embedded with Saudi's war effort in Yemen. And again, it's a disgrace. Again, it's iniquitous. But again, it's no surprise given where Britain is culturally and politically in this post-Brexit landscape.
Meanwhile, as of February this year, British officials authorized the export of almost £1.4 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia in the quarter after the UK resumed sales of weapons, generating public outrage.
It's all about money. It's all about money. Human rights is but a fig leaf when it comes to money. Britain's relationship with the Saudis. Britain enjoys a symbiotic security and defence relationship with the Saudis. They train Saudi RAF pilots. Saudi military officers are trained at Santos, Britain's renowned officer training school in the UK. They're on the ground in Saudi Arabia. They run train and equip operations. They maintain Saudi's air force. There are billions and billions in arms sold from the UK to the Saudis. Indeed, the Saudis are Britain's single biggest customer for recipient of US arms, and it's all about money. It's a source of revenue, and even more so now Britain is desperate for revenue after leaving the EU, and so it's willing to go to plumb even lower debts than it already has when it comes to propping up these unsavoury regimes in order to benefit financially from them.
The detention and torture of Mahra residents is just another horror to add to the list of the Saudi-led coalition's unlawful conduct in Yemen. But it's also another case in which the British government is aiding and abetting Saudi Arabia to go on with its inhumane crimes, putting profit before Yemeni lives.
Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools and reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. We now present you an article written jointly by Dipti Gurdasani and John Henley. The piece is titled, Why Are UK Government Experts Holding Off Vaccinating Under 16s in the UK? Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, JCVI, announced recently that everyone in the United Kingdom aged 16 and 17 should be offered the COVID-19 vaccine. Just several days ago, it said the vaccine wouldn't be offered to non-vulnerable people aged between 12 and 17. The change in position is welcome, but the reasons for the committee's two-week delay and its decision to not extend the vaccine to 12 to 15-year-olds are unclear. Unlike the US Center for Disease Control, the CDC, the committee has offered no quantitative analysis of the risk associated with vaccinating people in this younger age group. Delaying the rollout of the vaccine to adolescents is risky. Recent figures show that 1% of 10-year-old to 19-year-olds were being diagnosed with COVID-19 a week. Waiting for further data on vaccine safety when infections are ripping through younger age groups isn't cautious, it's reckless. This seems particularly clear given what we already know about the safety of vaccines in adolescents. The UK Medicines, Healthcare Products and Regulatory Authority claimed the Pfizer vaccine safe and effective for 16 and 17-year-olds in December of 2020, and stated that the benefits of this vaccine outweigh any risk when approving it for 12 to 15-year-olds in June of this year. In the United States, where officials claimed close to 9 million adolescents aged between 12 and 17 have been fully vaccinated, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has unambiguously recommended vaccines for those aged 12 and above. Worryingly, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunizations' recent announcement that only recommended the first dose of the vaccine for 16 to 17-year-olds. Millions of adolescents in this age group have been vaccinated with two doses in the United States and in other countries. And we know that full protection from the Delta variant of the coronavirus depends critically on receiving two jabs. So much data on this is already available. It's unclear why the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization needs yet more data to make an assessment that many countries made months ago. The choice in the United Kingdom now is between infection and vaccination. Given the high rates of infection among young people in the United Kingdom, there is little doubt that the benefits of vaccines far outweigh the risks. Vaccines also reduce the burden of long COVID by protecting people against infection. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, which has regularly followed up with thousands of people across the United Kingdom who have had COVID-19, finds that persistent illness is common, about 8% after infection among children. For many of those who become infected, COVID-19 is not a minor illness. Recently, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, estimates suggests that around 20,000 children aged under the age of 17 with long COVID currently suffer from its impact on their day-to-day lives. Some 7,000 children have been living with this for more than a year. Although only a few children may develop severe symptoms as a result of COVID-19, if thousands of children are infected, the number who become seriously ill can quickly stack up. It's puzzling that those who are nervous about vaccinating children due to the risk of extremely rare and typically minor side effects are not equally concerned about exposing children to a novel virus. We know that COVID-19 causes poorly understood multi-system long-term disease, even in young adults with mild infection, and is associated with thinning of brain gray matter. We also know it causes long-term neurological effects among hospitalized children, some of which may be permanent. High rates of infection among adolescents and younger people reflect the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, particularly in schools, where few safety measures have been put in place. Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools and reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. Reports from frontline clinicians across the globe suggest that more children are being seen in hospitals as a result of the Delta variant of the coronavirus and that more are requiring intensive care support. Meanwhile, six European Union states have now fully inoculated a larger share of their total populations with the coronavirus vaccine than the United Kingdom, after the bloc's dire initial rollout took off while Britain's impressive early jab rate has slumped. According to government and health service figures collated by the online science publication Our World in Data, Malta, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Denmark and Ireland have all overtaken the United Kingdom in terms of the percentages of their populations who are fully vaccinated. While Britain's campaign was bound to slow first as it ran into harder-to-reach, more vaccine-hesitant groups, the rate of decline is dramatic. Britain is currently administering a fraction of the daily doses of some European Union states. For example, on Wednesday, 4th of August, France administered 368,596 first doses of the vaccine and 261,695 second doses of the vaccine, while Britain's totals were 33,304 and 165,669 respectively. The data will put pressure on Boris Johnson's government to reboot a program that began supposedly as one of the world's fastest, but is now flagging, with 57.3% of the population fully jabbed and 69% partly vaccinated. Vaccination rates are rising only very slowly in every age group in the United Kingdom, but low take-up in the 18 to 29 cohort, due mainly to a perception that young people are not at risk, is marked and has alarmed ministers. Among the 18 to 30-year-olds, an estimated 33% or one-third are yet to get their first shot of the vaccine. According to the figures, Malta had fully vaccinated 88% of its total population by 4th of August, with 91% having had at least one dose of the vaccine. Belgium is on 61% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Spain on 60% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Portugal on 59% and 70%. Denmark on 58% and 73%. And Ireland on 57.4% and 68%. The gap appears likely to widen further, since several European Union states, while their rollouts have also slowed since June, are still administering both first and second doses significantly faster than the United Kingdom, whose first dose rate in particular has plummeted. The Netherlands is already ahead of the United Kingdom on first doses, while others, including France, are on course on current trends to overtake Britain on second doses shortly. According to Our World in Data, the European Union's 27 rolling 7-day average of daily doses per 100 people is currently 0.56 shots, almost double the UK's rate of 0.28 shots. Some European Union states are vaccinating faster than the bloc's average, and many times faster than Britain. For example, Denmark is managing a rolling 7-day average of 0.97 daily doses per 100 people, France 0.82, Belgium 0.80, Portugal and Ireland 0.77, Spain 0.73, and Italy 0.72. With the rapid spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus adding a new urgency to its slowing vaccine drive, France is one of several European Union countries to have adopted the kind of coercive tactics aimed at boosting take-up among vaccine-shy groups, including young people, that the British government has so far appeared reluctant to consider. Denmark, Italy, Greece, and most recently Germany have all adopted or mooted similar tough incentives to get vaccinated, while multiple European Union countries have also boosted take-up by opening up their vaccination offer to all over 12-year-olds, some since mid-June. In March, as Britain's vaccine rollout powered ahead, the World Health Organization, WHO, compared its unfavorable with Europe's, which is criticized as unacceptably slow. However, success is far from even across the bloc. Poorer member states such as Romania and Bulgaria, with less well-endowed public health services than wealthier neighbors such as Germany and the Netherlands, are struggling, with barely 26% and 15% of their respective populations vaccinated with at least one dose of the vaccine.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at Israel in response to the regime's airstrikes. The Lebanese president has denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and stability of the region. And the country's parliament speaker has said Israel only understands the language of unity and resistance. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look at the reasons behind the recent Israeli escalation and the significance of Hezbollah's response to the aggression.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabaa farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land, or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Well, joining us, we have Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Wakim, joining us from Beirut. Also, journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us from the British capital, London. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Wakim in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Wakim, how do you view the escalation of tensions, and also what are your views on the timing of all of this?
Well, I believe that what happened was an attempt by the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett, to prove himself stronger than his predecessor, Netanyahu, by changing the rules of engagement with Lebanon. So that's why he capitalized on an incident of firing two rockets on occupied Palestine to wage or to escalate the situation by waging air raids for the first time since 2014. And this was the response of the Islamic resistance was to wage this attack, which put things back to square one in this regard, because the Israelis didn't dare to react to this, and they chose to downgrade their reaction, and they didn't attack back. So that's why I believe that Bennett got embarrassed, and now he's facing mounting criticism inside Israel, especially from supporters of Netanyahu, who used this to as a mean to attack Bennett, who because Bennett himself used to criticize Netanyahu for not escalating his attacks against Lebanon in reaction to, let's say, launching rockets from Lebanese territories. So I believe that this was the reason why the new government, the new prime minister, was trying to test the ground and see if he can fare better than his predecessor facing the Islamic resistance. However, it proved him wrong, and he had to back down on this.
Said Mohsen Abbas in London. Hezbollah said the rockets were in retaliation for the Israeli attacks. A while back, if you recall, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Said Hassan Nasrallah, he said that they now had twice as many precision-guided missiles as they did a year ago. Has the capacity of resistance forces to respond changed the equation for the Israeli regime now?
It's changed it for a considerable amount of time. I mean, since 2006, Hezbollah has increased its capacity, both in terms of quality of military on the ground capability, but also with weaponry. They were particularly skilled in the 2006 war at using anti-tank weapons. Their light infantry was known to be in many ways superior to Israel on their home ground. The tactics that they used were extraordinarily effective in pushing back the Israeli invasion. In fact, Naftali Bennett was one of the soldiers who actually was a commanding officer within that invasion, and was also the victim of a defeat, and a bitter defeat. So some of this may well be also to do with him wanting to sort of readdress unfinished business, if you like. But the reality on the ground is this: that Hezbollah has the armed strength of a medium-sized army. Nobody knows the full capacity of weaponry and arsenal and power they have now. That's not something which certainly either Israel or anybody else can make a firm estimate on. Groups like the James group, they've assessed that Hezbollah has more than 25,000 full-time fighters and perhaps around 30,000 reservists. But all this is guesswork. What they do know is that Hezbollah has now also got skills in terms of maneuvers, strength of being able to maneuver in conventional warfare, given their experience in Syria and fighting ISIS and the Zio Western proxies out there. So there's no, I think, delusion on the part of the Israeli Defense Force that they're up against a very skilled, very motivated, very pious fighting force. You're not dealing with an ordinary army when you're talking about Hezbollah. These men are not just fighting for land. They have an ideological and spiritual commitment to defending the oppressed, which goes beyond your average soldier. They're certainly not in it for the money or being paid for by the American or the Israelis. And they're certainly not children or kids being conscripted by force to serve in the IDF. So overall, Israel may be testing the ground. They've been given their answer. I think that they'd be wise to take note and not continue any further aggressions on the Lebanese sovereignty.
Mr. Wakim, the recent attack on the Israeli tanker off the coast of Oman, that was seen as a response to the Israeli regime's hostile activity. Are regional resistance forces conveying the message now that there will be consequences for Israel's hostile behavior?
Well, I believe that this is true, because Israel is taking an all-out, let's say, attack on the resistance movement. However, the attack on Israeli tanker in the Sea of Oman is a clear message that Israeli aggressions will not pass without reaction. So this is very important. And at the same time, I believe that what's happening cannot be, in Lebanon, for example, is not detached from what's going on in the Sea of Oman or elsewhere in the Middle East.
Sure. Said Mohsen Abbas, the Arab League, in a statement, noted that the practices of the new Israeli administration, headed by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are meant to display its force. That's something that Mr. Joachim also alluded to. Do you think that that could have been the initial move for the new Israeli prime minister? And given the response now, are the Israelis in a dichotomy as to whether they should escalate their attacks or not?
Certainly it will be a part of the play, but don't forget the Islamic Republic of Iran has had just had a change of guard. The new president, Ayatollah Raisi, is now firmly in office. So generally, the Israelis are in a high state of nervousness. They understand that what's happening in Islamic Republic of Iran and what's happening even in Lebanon and in Yemen and in Syria is all, and of course Iraq as well, not to forget Iraq, is all ultimately focused with them in mind. The fact of the matter is the rising power, the rising strength, the rising unity of the Arab world, and including, of course, Iran as well in West Asia, is, of course, hugely worrying. Never before have the Israelis, not since certainly before Yom Kippur, the war back in the 70s, have they actually faced an adversary that was really, truly capable of challenging them. And they know this. Now, they're in a real quandary. If you don't go for the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Lebanon, of course, Hezbollah, if you don't take an action against them now as an Israeli military or even as a sort of a broader NATO, American, etc., alliance as well, then they're going to be calculating, the strategists in Israel will be calculating that this force will only grow. It'll only become more powerful. So what do you do? Do you tackle the resistance axis now and try to finish it off or push it back? Or do you just wait and hope that there isn't the strength within the resistance axis to ever actually fully take on Israel toe-to-toe in an open war? Well, this is between a rock and a hard place, really, for Israel. And they are really, I think, very, very confused as to what they ought to do. You can see they've been rattling the sabers, trying to draw in the world. That's what the language has been over this Sea of Oman issue that was raised. They've been trying to rally them to all come and attack Iran. Well, the fact is that they couldn't defeat Hezbollah and Lebanon in a 22-day war. They couldn't defeat the Palestinian resistance in a even shorter lived folly that most recently. What chance would they stand against the entire Islamic resistance axis if they were to rattle that little, nest of, hornets, from their point of view? I don't think that they really know what they're doing. So what they've actually been doing, and this military show is an act of bravado, but what they've been doing more cunningly, of course, don't forget, is that they've been trying to instigate civil war in Lebanon. They've the death of Ali Shibli, for instance, at a wedding, shot down by some extremist chaps, Ahmed Gonsa, I think the name of the gentleman is, who actually killed Ali Shibli, who was a member of Hezbollah, who's an active member, is one of those kind of incidents which is designed to stir tension, to create sectarian aggravations, and also, of course, to test Hezbollah. Hezbollah's been very cool and calm, and the whole incident has been toned down. But color revolution has been added to this desire to create sectarian civil war. That's been going on the back of the economic sanctions, which again are instigated by the Anglo-Zionist axis to try and bring Lebanon to its knees. So all of these things are going on: sabotage, proxy politicians within Lebanon, the economic sanctions, color revolutions. You know, they've tried everything to try and break Lebanon because primarily Hezbollah sits on their doorstep and they don't like it. And that's their main priority, is to try and divide and destroy their key opposition in the region.
Professor Joachim, the Arab League, as we're staying on that topic, warned that escalating hostilities between Lebanon and Tel Aviv regime could spiral out of control, adding that Lebanon has been passing through a difficult time and could not endure more tensions. When will these platitudes and mere words end? When will there be tangible action from the likes of the Arab League?
Well, I don't believe that there will ever be an action by the Arab League. The Arab League was first installed in 1945 by the British as an umbrella to control the Arab states and put them all the time under British and later on under American hegemony. So that's why I don't, throughout its history, except for the period in the 1950s and 1960s when Nasser ruled Egypt, but throughout its history, the Arab League was always a mirror of the Western resolutions and an accessory of British and then U.S. Policies in the region. So that's why we saw that all its resolutions would always fall in the benefit of the U.S. policies in the region. And this was best featured in the past three decades, whether in the blockade imposed by the U.S. on Iraq, later by its inability to oppose the invasion, the American invasion of Iraq, and then the conspicuous role of the Arab League in justifying many resolutions taken against Arab countries that are not abiding by the Western will, most important Syria, and the conspicuous role of the Arab League in Syria in this regard. So we don't count on the Arab League to stand as an independent actor, and we don't count on its resolutions whenever it comes to confronting Israel by an Arab country or by the Islamic resistance.
Said Mohsen Abbas, the Lebanese caretaker prime minister, has called on the UN to exert some pressure on the Israelis to halt its aggression on Lebanon. Are you expecting to see any response from the UN? The UN peacekeeping mission in Lebanon has also warned the situation is very dangerous. That's even more of a reason for the UN to take action now.
Well, the UN has proven itself to be a toothless tiger. It really is a defunct organization in terms of being able to prevent wars, that's for sure. They might have some arguments to say in terms of helping people who are victims of wars, etc. They may be able to go and do things like that. But really, they have no say and they have no power. You have a veto in the UN, which belongs to the Americans, and the Americans will use that veto every time to favor Israel to prevent any progress or any justice or fairness being exercised in that region. This is just a reality. In fact, the Americans have exercised that veto dozens and dozens of times, more for Israel than any other veto. That's the American track record. So you've got a block there. The UN just won't do anything. They can go through sort of platitudes and make noises and say how dangerous things are, but really they are not the answer. In fact, no international organization really is the answer. There is only one answer, and Ayatollah Khamenei, Sayyid Nasrallah have all pointed to this. The only language they understand, the Israelis and the Anglo-Zionist axis, is military and hard power. And I think that's the direction that Hezbollah went after seeing Israel's constant efforts to invade Lebanon. And they build up tactical strengths. They have, you know, fantastic skills in cover and concealment in their own territories, you know, in that terrain of South Lebanon, etc. They are great with direct fire, preparation of their fighting positions. You know, they've got lots of fabulous, fighters who are very capable of taking out tanks, and the Israelis much wanted tank squadrons,
right,
were heavy blows. So I don't see this Israel making this calculation. Even though they've got aerial power, aerial support, I don't think they can contemplate a head-on war with Hezbollah. 150,000 missiles, by their own admission, are sitting, waiting for any move that Israel makes. Now, you don't know what the scale of those ballistic missiles or those weapons are, because having been linked to Iran, goodness knows whether they've got the Bavar or whether they've got all the other, wonderful array of arsenal which Iran has been very publicly showing and actually demonstrated to America, too.
Indeed.
As to what it was capable of.
All right, one last question for Mr. Wakim. We've got probably less than a minute. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabi Berri, he said that the Israelis only understand the language of unity and resistance. How important are these two elements, unity and resistance when it comes to opposing the Israeli regime?
Well, I believe that this is very important. They have proved very important in the past four decades. Of course, power and strength, most important. Unity in Lebanon, too bad, we were never able to achieve unity, and the Islamic resistance had to pass through a lot of difficulties in the past four decades because of the lack of unity. But despite of this, it was able to achieve major victories over the Israelis, and that's why we believe that we will achieve victory in any confrontation that will occur in the future.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University.